Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
All right, welcome back to the Disruption Zone. This is part two of our discussion with former executive director of the Kentucky think tank Pegasus Institute, and we're exploring the situation in China. And I deliberately cut you off right at a very interesting point, so you have to listen to the second episode. But hey, at least I posted both episodes on the same day. So anyway, where we left it off, let me take you right back to this conversation. And the question was about China and where this is going to go in terms of this new ideological Cold War between us and China, which is setting up, and COVID-19 is making sort of the perfect playing stage for that. So back to the conversation and Jordan Harris's answer.
That coming out of this, they need to be able to make the argument that only their system of government, only their structure was able to properly handle a problem like this and properly handle a pandemic like this. This will be something that the Chinese leaders, not only with their own population, but with others, other countries, point to and say, look at the way that our system was able to handle this versus the way that the American system was able to handle this, or versus the way the French system was able to handle this. And so that's one of the things that make it such a turning point moment, is that the lines are drawn from this as to the differences that exist between our structure of government and their structure of government. You know, it after the this has been coming. We've known this has been coming. This is one of the things that Trump is so right about, I mean, I might be a single issue voter in 2020, and that single issue might be what we do about how seriously we take China.
Right.
But this has been coming for a long time. You know, Leland, in the Eisenhower administration, we're going back all the way to the Eisenhower administration. In the Eisenhower administration, the State Department had this query in front of them, which was, how did we lose China? You know, coming out of the Chinese Civil War, our good friend Chiang Kai-shek lost the war. Mao and the Communist Party won the war. Chiang Kai-shek was relegated to a small piece of land, and the Chinese Communist Party took over the entire country. And the American government blamed itself, essentially, for failing in the aftermath of the Second World War, where we had to where we worked closely with China to defeat the Japanese. But failed to direct the country towards a more democratic system. And of course, the United States refused to recognize the Chinese Communist Party as the government until Eisenhower and Kissinger went to see Mao in the 1970s and opened up relations. Since the moment we opened up relations with China in the Nixon administration, the calculation on the part of the United States has been, if we can open up aspects of their economy, if we let them choose the color of their car, eventually they will want to choose their leaders.
Right.
We've had 40 plus years to test that theory, and we are nowhere closer, it seems, to democratic governance in China than we were in the early 1970s.
Right.
And so that theory, that American theory about the relationship with China, has failed. And I think that the coronavirus and this pandemic should be the final nail in the coffin of that theory. We are fundamentally different countries who have strictly, fundamentally different views about how the world should be governed and about how our individual countries should be governed.
Right.
And that we are always going to be at odds with that. And so we need American leaders to understand that fact, and we need American leaders to position our worldview to win. One of the things that Condoleezza Rice said for years during the Obama, critiqued the Obama administration heavily because the Obama administration pulled back on U.S. influence in many places And U.S. influence does not have to mean that we drone people in Syria and Yemen. Right. That's not what that
means.
It doesn't
mean we have to control every other country or be the world's police. It means we exert influence for democracy around the world.
Exactly right. From the way we structure trade agreements, something that Trump understands, to the way we use soft power, all of those things which are part of geopolitical policy. But Condoleezza Rice was extremely critical of the Obama administration and the ways that they pulled back on American influence, because she said, if the United States pulls back, someone will step up to fill the void. Now, China has recognized that fact. And the way in which they filled the void is that they've provided cheap labor for the pharmaceutical companies. They have gobbled up mineral rights all around Africa and South America and all around South Asia. They have positioned themselves to eventually be able to take back the South China Sea. They have stolen our patents and basically just been 6 months behind us on technology and refused to allow our businesses to flourish in some of the largest markets in the world, because they've allowed their own companies. They've incentivized their own companies through state partnerships to operate in China by giving them discounts on corporate taxes and other things that encourage those industries to operate inside the country. They, for decades, have recognized the way in which they had to position themselves for a moment exactly like this that would allow them to step up and to say, our system is the superior system. These people are not stupid. The Communist Party saw what happened to the Soviet Union. There, you know, there were two different onlookers at the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was us who said, this is the end. We have won. Our worldview has won, which is true. It did. The collapse of the Soviet Union proved that our worldview won. China watched what happened to the Soviet Union and said, we have to avoid that fate.
Right.
And since that moment, since the moment when the Berlin Wall came down and Gorbachev allowed for reforms to take place, the Chinese Communist Party has worked endlessly to position itself for a moment exactly like this, where they could show that their worldview, that their system of government and their structure was superior to the West. And this is it. Yeah. And our leaders have to realize that this is the fight of our lifetimes as it relates to foreign policy. We have bothered ourselves with inconsequential skirmishes in the Middle East for two decades that wasted trillions of dollars, that wasted thousands of American lives and accomplished virtually nothing as it relates to geopolitical positioning. Accomplished nothing. And all the while, China has been waiting for a moment exactly like this one. And it's going to reshape the way international politics and international relations works for the next two decades. And so with all that being said, it makes perfect sense why, Leland, they would have lied as much as they have around this entire situation. Why would they lie about the origin of the virus? Why would they lie about the extent of the virus, the containment of the virus? All of those things, whenever you realize the way in which the Chinese Communist Party operates and their long-term macro-level goals, it all becomes clear as to why they've acted the way that they've acted in the wake of this.
A couple of observations. One, that I think that the legacy of President Obama will be that he ironically destabilized the Middle East even more than what it was during the Bush years. And that led to, without him intending to, I don't think that was his intention.
Right. A once unthinkable feat, by the way.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And in doing so, that allowed us or created the conditions where we did exactly what you said. We wasted two decades and trillions of dollars fighting futile fights that really we had no business fighting and had no real strategic reason to be fighting. I mean, if we find a terrorist camp, we can take them out in 10 minutes. We don't need to be setting up democracies over there. It's not our job in that sense. Second observation would be this is why truth in this case and in this story matters so much. It's why the president revoking funding for the WHO matters so much because of the connection between the Communist Party and the World Health Organization. It's why you know, when you mentioned why they would lie, I mean, that's why the truth of this is so important, because if China wins the propaganda war, which the media right now in America is helping them do.
Yes, oh, completely. Yes.
Then they could potentially win that Cold War that we're setting up again between the two worldviews. That's why this is so vital. I agree with you about being a one issue voter in this. I don't think you could understate the importance of what's been set up here, which leads me to this question. I have two theories working in my head about what China did here. I do not subscribe to the theory that they created this virus to unleash upon the world. However, I do subscribe to the theory they were messing with it, and that they probably got it accidentally got out, but that because they were prepared, as you said, for a moment such as this, I have two working theories on what they did after that. And maybe they both are exactly right, and maybe it's one or the other. I don't know, but I'll get your comments on it. One is that they saw that this was going to devastate their economy, and they said, well, hell, let's infect everybody by sending planes all over the world so that there's an even playing field. Or, and maybe that's the craziest of the two theories. Or the other theory is exactly what kind of what you've been saying. It was always about trying to control the message once it did get out, that if we're all in this together, was their thinking, then we will set up that chess match between these two thoughts of how the world ought to operate. I don't know. Your comments on that?
So one, the Chinese Communist Party is an entity of self-preservation.
Right.
This is one of the things that Americans have to understand about it. There is no free press, and there's very little check on the what the Chinese Communist Party says. But more than anything, the entity is an entity of self-preservation. And so the natural instinct of the Communist Party in China is to lie. Whenever something bad happens, it is to lie and cover up in the aim of preserving the Chinese Communist Party and in the aim of preserving the good look of the Communist Party. An example of that, some may remember a few years ago when two trains collided with one another in a Western province in China. And the two trains collided because the government had failed to properly schedule the routes and do all the things that need to be done. And the two trains ended up colliding with each other and multiple people died. The original press releases from the Chinese Communist Party, the original position of the Chinese Communist Party in that instance was that they had been struck by lightning.
Right.
And that's what caused that. So so I think that the second theory is not only probable, but it's been proven over and over that that's the direction that China goes. And let me say just a few things about here's what we know about the virus and about its relation to the Wuhan labs. Okay, it's just a theory that we will never know who patient zero was, and we will probably never know definitively where it came from. But here's what we know about the labs. One, that in the past 8 to 10 years that the Chinese have been obsessed with studying different types of coronaviruses, that the labs in Wuhan were a particular headquarters of studying coronaviruses, that the most prominent scientists who studied bats in the entire country worked in the Wuhan labs and would go, quote, deep into caves and find bats to bring them out to study viruses that they were carrying, because animals carry tons of viruses, obviously, and sometimes they jump to humans. And there's no doubt that I agree with what you said at the outset. I don't think that there's any evidence whatsoever that this was created, that it's a sort of a biochemical weapon. This follows the same pattern of a virus that jumped from animals to humans, just like AIDS did, just like swine flu did, etc. You know, all of that's a very common pattern. So, but we know for sure that was being studied in the Wuhan labs. We know that several years ago that two different international bodies said that they were concerned about the security at the Wuhan labs. We know that there have been grants given and outside help even to come in to try to improve the security and the conditions of the Wuhan labs. So the thesis, or the theory rather, that the virus came out of the Wuhan labs is and just jumped from, got out by mistake, was someone was infected, they didn't know they were infected, it ended up spreading outside of the lab, all of those things, backed up by several things. And I think that there are many serious people who support that,
right,
who support that theory. And I think that it's one that every serious person should consider. And U.S. intelligence is currently looking at that theory themselves and seeing what they can discover about that.
Right.
And then what we know for certain is that after this came out, after the infection started to take place, that the Chinese Communist Party lied repeatedly about the nature of it, how it was transmitted, how many people were infected, how fatal it was, all of those things. And then the World Health Organization, they refused to allow the World Health Organization in December and in January. And then finally in February allowed the World Health Organization to come into the country, but did not allow them to do site visits in Wuhan. And after the World Health Organization was allowed to come in without doing a site visit, they simply started repeating the Chinese Communist Party's talking points on this. Now, I think that the World Health Organization was doing that in the hopes of gaining more access in the future and being able to do more studies in the future. I don't even think that they were under some sort of malicious directive to follow the dictums of the Chinese Communist Party, although they have carried the water of the Communist Party as it relates to Taiwan for the better part of a decade. But that's a separate issue. So it's one who is suspicious of whose intentions has a lot of evidence to back up their suspicion. But in this particular instance, I think that what was happening was that they were hoping to get more access. Well, in failing to be critical and failing to provide the scientific and academic scrutiny that the world deserves and the world should expect from an organization like that, they gave us bad information, false information, and delayed our ability to react.
Right.
And so remember the way that this timeline kind of breaks down. We had no idea how bad it was coming out of China, partially because in January and February, the World Health Organization, repeating the lines of the Communist Party, had told us that it couldn't be transmitted human to human, that there were no instances of community spread, and that we shouldn't worry that much about the relative fatality rates. Okay.
Right.
And then Italy starts to melt down in early March, and we see instances in northern Italy where we have death rates as high as 7%. And the rest of the world, what happened in Italy was the first time that the world actually got accurate data,
right,
of any kind on the virus.
Right.
And it may have been the worst particular place where that data could have come from, because it was particularly vulnerable.
Right.
But it was the first time that we got accurate data because the Chinese Communist Party and the World Health Organization had been lying for nearly 2 months, for over 2 months at that point.
So what should be the consequences then? To China, what can we do to them after this?
Well, I think that one of the first things that we've learned from this is that the United States has to pursue policies of repatriation, that the businesses and the manufacturing that is essential for our country has to come back home, and that, you know, the sort of economic purist in me does not want to see the federal government incentivize private businesses to come back to the United States. I mean, I've always been a little bit leery of that scenario, you know, that isn't really a protectionist policy, but policies like that make me uncomfortable. But my goodness, has this not made completely clear that we have to pursue some kind of relevant policies of repatriation, where our own pharmaceuticals are being made here, where our own PPE is being made here, where all the things that are essential at a time like this are being made in the United States, and that we never have to be dependent on a foreign nation that is somewhat adversarial to ensure that our people have the medicine and that our doctors have protective equipment.
Yeah.
That's one. I think that the world should look seriously at ways that it can sanction China for sanctions are another thing that make me uncomfortable generally. But it's one of the only economic levers that the international apparatus has to use in a moment like this. And so some sort of punitive measure like that, I don't think would be completely inappropriate in this particular instance. But I think that the absolute number one thing that has to happen is for Western governments to unify in sort of ideological defense of their own worldview. And, right. You know, this is something that the postmodern left in this, and especially in our country, but in the Western world as a whole, has tried to deteriorate for the better part of four decades. And especially in the last decade and a half, was to make us ashamed of the superiority of our civilization.
Right.
Well, boy, we better jump back on the bandwagon of Western superiority real quick.
Right.
Here in the Western world, because I assure you that the Chinese intellectuals do not sit around their universities feeling guilty about their belief that China is a superior civilization. And right. They're going to do everything in their power to prove to the world that their civilization is superior. And so even more than any economic sanction can do, this should be a unifying moment for the Western world and for the countries that believe, like we do, the democratic self-governance is the best form of governance, and that free economies and free people are the best outcome of the human experience.
Well, one final observation on that, just thinking about that coming ideological war ahead. You know, for a long time, those of us who are liberty-minded have wondered, gosh, what would someone like Mao or Stalin or Hitler or, you know, any of the awful dictators and horrible people of the last century or so have done if they had had at their fingertips the type of technology that we have today. What we didn't realize is that we were watching that right under our noses. China is, you know, there are people in China that want to choose their own rulers, but they'll never get to. Because China is able to put out small fires right. Here and there as they occur, because
absolutely.
They have a complete surveillance state. And so I don't want to minimize the ideological battle that it took World War II to have surface and then the Cold War to show. But honestly, I think this one is even more pivotal, because whoever gets that power, I mean, that's something I don't even want to think about, living in a police state. And we're seeing little shades of that in how America is dealing with the coronavirus. And now there's even people talking about levels of surveillance you would have never imagined. But imagine that in the hands of a tyrant who has complete power.
Absolutely.
That's a terrifying
absolutely.
Thought.
That's a perfect application, a very real and practical application of what that worldview looks like on a grand scale.
Yeah.
That the way in which the Chinese keep their people under constant surveillance, the way in which they control their actions through an all-seeing nanny state, the possibility of that is only going to grow with as technology grows over the course of the century. And so the ideological question, we're guilty of two things related to this. One, we're treating those ideological questions as if they are just relegated to academics in a university to talk to, and that they don't have a real world impact on our lives. No, those ideological battles have a very real world impact on our lives. And the other thing that we do sometimes is think about countries like China as if that the leadership is just sort of blindly power hungry, and that they have no sort of intellectual backing whatsoever, that they don't sort of operate under the attempt to preserve their worldview or to preserve what they have. These people are not going to take this lying down.
Right.
China has always, this is especially true since Mao, believed that its place was to be ruling the world, that China was the dominant civilization of the world for multiple centuries. The Chinese they don't view history as beginning in 1776 like we Americans do,
right.
which is good. I mean, there's parts of that I like. It's like Ron Swanson says, history began in 1776. Everything else was a mistake. So I like that about the American mentality. There's a lot of benefits to it, but the Chinese mentality is very long view focused, and they right. view civilization in centuries, and they are working to make sure that their civilization achieves again the place they believe it deserves, which is to be the dominant civilization on Earth. And they will pursue that endlessly. And there are very real, practical, life-altering implications of whether or not that worldview wins out. And we Americans need to wake up real quick and get past these ridiculous conversations about identity politics and real and all these other things that bog down our views and bog down our conversations, and realize that perhaps the single most important ideological challenge of the century is staring us right in the eye and has been brought to the forefront by the coronavirus.
Okay, but here's the scariest thought of this entire conversation. We're not ready for it. Because here's the thing. When we fought the Cold War with Russia, we had a longer view. Like, maybe it only went back to 1776, but there was an understanding of what happened there amongst, you know, we taught history to our kids. Now, you know, the thing that aggravates me the most about the youngest generation, and I know every generation complains about the generation that comes after it. It's part of getting older. But there's a real systemic problem in our society here that goes beyond generational issues, but it is a generational issue. And that is that somehow or another, the left has succeeded in taking over the school systems in such a way that identity politics is the only politics that they're being taught, and that there is the best way to get somebody to engage in stupid, irrelevant discussions is to remove all context from their thinking. And so this idea of like, for instance, how much time did we waste at the beginning of this crisis arguing over whether we should call it the Wuhan virus or whether that's racist? When there's no context, people don't realize that we have always named viruses after the geographical region that they came from. But there's no context. So suddenly it's this racist thing, and we squabble with each other over stupid stuff like that. And it's like, we're not prepared, not only ideologically, but intellectually. We're not rigorous enough. Not enough of us have faced a true challenge to our life in a way that toughens us for what will be an ideological and intellectual challenge of the last three or four generations. I mean, it's that big, I think. I don't mean to overblow it, but I think it's that big.
There's no way to overblow it. I mean, because it's that level of seriousness. There's no way to overstate exactly what you just said, because it's that level of seriousness. But I agree entirely with every word of what you just said. You know, I wonder about the thing about that generation that came out of the Second World War that we refer to as the greatest generation is that generation had seen true atrocity.
Right.
They had seen the ills of a government or of government action that was different from the American system. They had watched it, and they had defeated it on foreign land, on foreign soil. They went to foreign soil and they defeated those ideas. And they understood the superiority of our system of government and of the way that we believe in human beings and the dignity that our system affords to human beings, all of those things. The generations that are governing the country now, the generations that are in positions of authority and in decision-making positions are completely ignorant of that. And largely, many of them, ignorant to the dialogues even of the 1980s whenever the Soviet Union was collapsing. And so even missed in some ways the tail end of that sort of conversation in which we showed that our worldview one out. And I'm extremely, like you, terrified about that. And this is something that we conservatives have been talking about for a long time as being a very serious problem, that, as you already referenced, that really theories of identity politics and post-structuralism and all of these sort of deconstructionism, all of these theories that dominated the academy and all of these theories that have dominated the discussions in the New York Times editorial board and in the Atlantic and every other possible entity, which have completely altered the way Americans view their own system, have completely reshaped the way people think about, you know, how to compare two systems of government. All of those questions have put us in an extremely weak position to deal with this. And I go back to what I said before. All the while, for decades and decades, the Chinese have spent no time debating whether or not their system was, in fact, the world's superior system. They have always believed that their system was the superior system. And so that's one of the reasons that I said that the biggest, you know, one of the biggest things that we can do out of this is that we in the Western world need to wake up. You know, it wasn't just the United States that defeated the Soviet Union, defeated that worldview. It was our allies in Western Europe, and it was NATO and all of those countries which came together, some of them under imminent threat, but some of them because they recognized the importance of democratic self-governments and of a system that respected individuals. The same thing is going to have to be true coming out of this. And those same parties are going to have to step up to the plate and do that. And that's true on both sides of the aisle in this country, too. I mean, I worry sometimes that the right has too narrow a worldview about some of these things itself, that it's over, that the right is growing emergingly overly concerned with questions even about legal immigration and questions about protectionism and pulling back from the world entirely. There's definitely a strain of that exists on the right that's equally worrisome to all of the poor interests and directions that's on the left as well.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Well, Jordan Harris, congratulations. This is officially the longest Disruption Zone podcast
that
we've ever done, but I wouldn't change a word of it because it might be the most important. So
hey,
you know what I mean?
I'm gonna put that on a t-shirt.
There you go. Man, I really appreciate it. It's a great conversation. I hope that not only will people listen to this, I hope that there'll be people that listen to this that maybe come into the conversation disagreeing with mine and your political worldview, but maybe agreeing with our grander worldview, because I think there's unity to be had here, right? I mean, we can squabble left versus right, but I remember a time when Democrats would have, you know, they would have, I'm trying to find the right words here. They would have peed all over a communist flag and set it on fire. Okay, I mean there was a time when Democrats and Republicans could do that together.
Oh, there's a generation of liberals in this country who I have a tremendous amount of admiration for.
Yeah.
John Dewey, Walt Whitman, Arthur Schlesinger, that group. And one of the things that I have a tremendous amount of respect for that group about is they believe that America was an exceptional country.
Right. Right.
And they believed that the things that America achieved and had achieved were something that we should be proud of as a people, and that no other country on earth could do what America did. That was a foundational principle for some of the greatest thinkers in the history of the American left.
Yeah.
And the postmodern left, which dominates a major chunk of the American left now, is the antithesis of that. They not only don't believe in American exceptionalism, they don't even believe in the benefits of the Enlightenment. So,
right.
I mean, they go back even further in trying to undermine the value of our civilization. But I do think that there are a lot of liberals who still hold those same doctrines that Dewey and Whitman and others held, that understand that this country is an exceptional country, and that our worldview matters, and that the founding documents matter, and the things that we fundamentally believe in matter. And that they are beneficial not only for the people who live within our borders, but they are beneficial for all people.
You know, right after 9/11, all of Congress, both parties gathered and stood on the steps of the Capitol and sang God Bless America. That might be the last time that we were able to put our differences aside and tackle a big problem that threatened the future of our nation. And I hope that that's not the case, which is why I hope people listen to this with an open mind. And maybe share it, because this is a conversation that needs to be had a lot more often in a lot higher circles than you and I walk in, and with a lot more urgency. So, hey, thanks for coming on. Really appreciate it. Great talking to you again. Can't wait to announce what you're up to and have further conversations about all of this, my friend.
Absolutely. Thank you, Leland.
All right. It's the Disruption Zone. Wow, congratulations, for real. You just made it through the longest episode ever of the Disruption Zone. And like I said to Jordan, I wouldn't change a freaking word of it. It's just too important of a conversation. I actually, to be honest, when we started talking, I didn't think it was going to go into as blossom into the kind of conversation it was. But it actually, one, it shows that there's a bigger issue afoot here than just the coronavirus. Viruses come and go. Humans die and survive. It happens. I'm not minimizing it, but there's a bigger ideological thing going on here, and that's why I think this is really not only maybe the longest episode we've ever done, but it might actually be the most important. So I hope that you will share this with your friends, and if you like what we're doing here, gosh, please share it. It's a free subscription on Apple Podcasts, on Google Play, on iHeartRadio's app. Just go to iHeartRadio's app and search The Disruption Zone, and it will deliver me and all my guests right to your pocket. It comes in an email when there's a new episode up. It's a bam, deliver right to you. So hopefully we'll be able to continue this, and the way we continue this is for the audience to continue to grow. And so if you can share it with your friends, let them know that they can subscribe for free, let them know that it's an awesome podcast and that we're trying to speak for liberty-loving Americans. And we're not going to be all politics. It's had to be COVID and it's had to be politics sometimes lately, but I have grand goals and designs for this podcast to become even much more than politics, to talk to fascinating people from across all realms of life, and we're going to take it in that direction. But for the time being, because this is what America is facing, I'm staying focused on that because I feel like that's my duty as someone with an audience. We need to talk about the things that matter most to you and me, and that's this right now. So anyway, any way that you can share it with your friends is a big help to us. You can follow us on Twitter. It's at Zone Disruption because some jackwagon stole Zone Disruption Zone. So it's Zone Disruption on Twitter. And of course, I'm Leland Show. And then on Instagram, it's at The Disruption Zone, and I am at Greatly Londo. So we'd love to have you there. Thanks to my co-host and co-executive producer, Cameron Mills, who will be back with us soon. We got an episode coming out here shortly with him involved. So appreciate him and his help. And also Dynamics Productions, dxaudio.com, if you want to know more, whether you just want to take a video project, maybe an old VHS tape, and upgrade it to something that can play on your system now, they can do that all the way up to a Hollywood production. He's actually worked on Hollywood productions. Major stars have come into his studio in Lexington and done things for major movies. It's pretty cool stuff. He's one of the best audio engineers in the world, in my opinion. He's the best I know, Neil Kesterson over there. And they provide the music for this program and some production advice as well. So I appreciate them. Thanks again for listening. I am Leland Conway. You're listening to The Disruption Zone.